I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the New Statesman podcast that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich. This week we're talking about the film Tully and the Netflix original Dude.
Anna has also listened to the Bright Sessions podcast for the first time, so we'll be hearing how that went later in the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. It's been a pop culture filled morning for me, Caroline. Last night, the video for Childish Gambino's song This Is America appeared on the internet. In 24 hours, it's had 10 million views, which is crazy.
Which is quite a lot, yeah.
It's been a huge discussion point, I think, because it's quite a jarring and violent video that kind of jumps between tones. So you have Childish Gambino, Donald Glover, one moment being really kind of like performing delight and being really effusive and dancing and doing all these kind of exaggerated facials and doing all these kind of exaggerated facial expressions, and other moments he's stony faced, he's talking to camera, and he's just like shooting people in the head.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's being read very much, and it undoubtedly I think is intended as a comment on gun violence and police brutality towards black people in the US and so on. You know, the whole refrain of the song is just like, this is America. Like, these horrible things happen in America. Don't pretend they happen somewhere else because they happen here. And yeah, it's this amazing cocktail of different motifs and like all the like different dances that he's referencing, and his own like performance in it is just straight up amazing. And the whole thing's been shot to look like it's one single tracking shot around this massive warehouse as well, which is really interesting. So yeah, I'm really glad to see that it's getting so much attention.
Yeah, and it's totally also about, I think, that experience of what it's like to live in a culture that is one second throwing entertainment at you and the next violence, and how those two spectacles, entertainment and violence, are basically the pillars that are propping up American society. And you can just like, you're on that jump in tone is sort of like how I feel sometimes when you're reading the news on your phone and it's like, Chrissy Teigen Chrissy Teigen clapped back at this person on Twitter, and then the next thing there's a school shooting. It's this very weird just jumping between two kinds of experience constantly. And so it's really jarring and kind of horrible to watch. And so I can't say I like enjoyed watching it, but it's a clever kind of comment on where we're at societally. And then one other thing that I really enjoyed consuming this morning in that vein is the Met Ball, which had a Catholicism theme this year. And as usual, was full of people either really committing to theme or absolutely just putting on a nice dress and like wearing a crucifix.
Yep. Yeah. So the theme, I think, is like heavenly bodies, Catholicism, something and something, because that's the big exhibition that the Met is celebrating. And yeah, some people went full on, I will dress like an icon from a medieval painting, like Lily Collins was one of those people. And then
Lana Del Rey as well, like fully had symbolism all over her in this weird 3D way. It was bizarre.
Madonna herself dressed like Madonna's been dressing for decades in like black fishnetted sort of faux demure veil, all that
Madonna
stuff.
Madonna is the reference for this kind of theme, I think.
But then performed. Some other people, like I thought SZA looked absolutely amazing. She was wearing this sort of like rosy, purpley chiffon thing, but she just had a sort of halo on her head. And I was like,
the halo is a popular one, but I thought SZA looked great because she had loads of adornments on her face.
But she didn't look very Catholic.
Maybe, but I mean, she was doing so much more work than like the Kardashian Jenners. Like, Kim Kardashian came in a gold dress with two crucifixes on it. Kendall Jenner came in like a white pantsuit thing that was just normal.
Yeah, but I never expect much from them on this regard. They wear things that maybe look amazing for their bodies and stuff, but they don't necessarily lean hard into the concept.
It's literally, there's no concept at all behind it. I enjoyed, SZA wasn't the only one with that kind of halo effect. Lana Del Rey had one, Lily Collins, you mentioned, she had one. Blake Lively, who was wearing this like absolutely enormous dress, had one. My favourite, of course, Rihanna dressed fully as the Pope.
Yep, that was fantastic.
Just as a silver glittering Pope with like a mitre and everything. Absolutely incredible. I loved what Greta Gerwig was wearing, which was just this enormous, voluminous nun type thing.
I saw someone on Twitter described it as Maria before she gets worn down by all the children and the Sound of Music. And I was like, yeah, that is what she would wear.
Oh, I love a Sound of Music reference. I need one of those every day. Yeah, just some really beautiful stuff going on by the people who fully committed to theme. Love it. Respect it.
I adore it. I liked what Lena Dunham was wearing, actually. She came in like a full gold Elizabethan dress, which
she kind of had the rough sort of vibe. Yeah, I also really enjoyed on the cut, Patricia Lockwood and her mother reviewed all the dresses.
This was fabulous. I will link to it in the show notes because even if you haven't really looked at any of the pictures, it's just very, very funny. Because Patricia Lockwood, if you don't know her, is a poet, and she wrote a memoir called Priest Daddy, which is all about growing up with a Catholic priest as your father in a large family in very religiously conservative way. And yeah, she and her mother had some strong thoughts about the ways in which Catholicism was being portrayed in all of these outfits.
Yep, so that was amazing. Anyway, what are we talking about this week?
So yeah, the first thing we're going to talk about is Tully, which is a dramatic movie written by Diablo Cody, who you may know as the screenwriter for Juno, and among other things. It also stars Charlize Theron, and it focuses on Theron's character of Marlo, who is a stressed out mother expecting her third child, and her developing relationship with the night nurse they get once the baby is born, who seems to have an uncanny ability to solve all of Marlo's problems.
It's a Diablo Cody written and Jason Reitman directed movie. And the two work together as writer and director on Juno and also on Young Adult, which also stars Charlize Theron, if you've seen that. So I was quite excited about this film. And it kind of opens with a pretty claustrophobic montage of new motherhood that involves, you know, lots of... I think maybe the very opening scene, you've seen it much more recently than me, Caroline, so do correct me, but I think maybe the very opening scene is like the car, the school run.
It's Marlo taking her two older children, Jonah and Sarah, to school. Jonah has some kind of undiagnosed behavior problems, maybe you would call that, but no one, you know, they don't ever... He doesn't have a kind of proper diagnosis or anything like that. He's just, quote, like a problem, quirky child. And he just finds loud noises startling and like sometimes has tantrums. And he's kicking the back of her seat incredibly hard. Like so hard, I was actually worried that she was maybe going to go into labor. And her daughter Sarah is yelling as well. And it's just, I mean, I don't have children. It's just exactly the kind of thing I imagine what would happen if I did, you know, and it looks awful.
Yeah, it's a great contraceptive, those opening scenes. And there's a whole sort of montage of the struggle she has with the youngest newborn child and then with the other two kids as well. And then at the end of this, these sort of sweaty, claustrophobic, hideous long days that are just constant screaming children and stress.
And mess and like poo everywhere and just general horror. Also, we should point out that she does have a husband. Like, she's not doing this on her own. There is a husband, but for whatever reason, he's been allowed to kind of slide into this role of like the guy who goes to work and like kisses her on the forehead, never gets up in the night to help with the baby, seems to like play Halo a lot or whatever with his headphones on, and just sort of leaves her to it.
Exactly. So at the end of these long days that are sort of a montage of, you know, hideousness, you get him coming home and saying like, oh, frozen pizza for dinner. Great.
Yeah. Oh my God, I wanted to kill him in that moment.
And he's actually not really a villain. He's not painted as a villain at all, but it's that kind of carelessness that just undermines an entire day of stress and work and the difficulty of and the isolation. Like, even your husband just doesn't understand how difficult it is because he's not actually there to see those long hours.
He's the kind of character who would to his friends describe looking after his kids on a Saturday as babysitting.
But he's caring in other ways, and he's clearly concerned about his wife's mental health, and he asks, you know, how she's doing, and he's very keen to, you know, pay money for this night nurse to help out the family. Marlowe's brother is extremely wealthy and has a sort of picture perfect skinny wife and three children, and he suggests the night nurse. So that's where this kind of quite luxurious middle class idea comes into this fairly working up to lower middle class home. And it seems like a great extravagance, but after a lot of stress, seemingly they go for it, and Tully appears at the door, and she's just kind of everything that you would want in that situation. She's young and she's got loads of energy and she's exuberant, but she's very caring and she speaks in a very kind of calm tone, and she's very subservient and suppliant. And she just is like, I'm here to look after you. And that involves looking after the baby and also maybe making some cupcakes for your kids to take to school. And there's just no detail that goes ignored by Tully. And then as the film goes along, her role in the family becomes more and more intense. And then there's kind of a third act.
I think we should, because I would like to talk about this, but I think also it helps if you're going to see the film to not know what happens in it. So let's say heavy spoiler warning from here on. So yeah, go on, say about the third
act. Yeah, there's kind of a third act twist. And as Caroline says, I would go in not knowing about it. But Tully's involvement in the family becomes more and more intense. And then all these signals start to appear that actually this relationship is maybe not what it seems, because, you know, they go on a road trip together and that seems very odd. And she starts to try and reinvigorate their sex life by having sex with the husband in a little waitress's outfit. And you're like, okay, this seems a bit much. And then you start to wonder whether Tully actually even really exists outside of the mind of Marlowe.
Yeah, and that's, in the end, what you come to realize, that this is basically Fight Club but with diapers, and that she's essentially and it all comes full circle when, you know, she has a car accident when she thinks she's in the car with Tully and actually there's no one else there. And when she's in the hospital, you see her husband giving basic details to the nurse or whatever, and she asks, oh, what's her maiden name, and he says Tully. And you're like, oh, okay, so it was actually just a projection of her younger self, or what she hoped her younger self was like, or what she herself could be like again the whole time. And she'd been alone all that time, that the cupcakes and the brilliantly clean house and the great sleeping and all the rest of that, that was all her. She was she was both of them, and she'd like worked herself into total exhaustion, and yeah, then like runs off the road and nearly dies. So yeah, that is essentially the film. I didn't really like it very much.
That's interesting. It's had really good reviews.
Yeah, I found it quite uncomfortable.
What did you find uncomfortable about it?
Well, I think it sort of presents having this kind of serious mental health problem as like an almost natural consequence of having a baby. in a way. Like, I think, well, no, that's not quite right, but I think it conflates like what I think gets called like postpartum depression or like baby blues with something totally different.
Yeah, psychotic break.
Which is having a psychotic break where you are like envisioning other individuals that talk to you. And I don't think the two really have anything to do with each other, but this film sort of suggests that they do.
It's a bit ambiguous as well, isn't it? Because it was actually not clear to what extent that Marlo is actually convinced that there is this real person, Tully, in her home and speaking to her, and to what extent she's projecting a persona that she wants to live up to, and to what extent she's saying, well, like, if I was here and I was 20 and I had energy, maybe I would be able to stay up all night and like make these cupcakes, or maybe I'd be able to put on this cute outfit and please my husband. And whatever that it's that at no point do we actually get, which I think is to the film's benefit, at no point do we actually get a sort of explanation from Marlo saying like, well, this is what I thought was happening.
No, that's true.
So you can kind of read it in two ways. You can read it as like her genuinely having a full, as you say, Fight Club style hallucination, where she's not remembering what she's doing when she's quote Tully, and she has no concept that other people don't think Tully is real, but she's obviously living her life in a way that her husband has managed to not cotton on that this is happening. So it can't be as simple as it seems. But I really struggled with it too. And as the reviews have started to come out, I've started to feel like maybe I'm a bit in a minority, but I really liked the first half until the twist. I thought it was a really good portrait of how difficult motherhood is. And we're really having a moment, I think, in culture at the moment where motherhood's getting reconsidered, because we've got things like Tully, and we've also got things like Sheila Hetty's motherhood. Jacqueline Rose has just done a book of essays called Mothers. There's another film coming out with Dominic Cooper and Gemma Arterton called The Escape that's all about how difficult motherhood is.
Even a Quiet Place was about this in a way, wasn't it? You know, it was like reimagining horror from a parent's point of view. One thing I did quite like about this film, but maybe others with more direct experience of this would feel differently, is that I thought the way it portrayed the relationship between Marlo and her son Jonah was quite good. You know, in that it didn't like label him as anything in particular. She herself gets really angry when teachers at the school try and like call him quirky, and she's like, what does that mean? What are you saying? What are you saying is wrong with him? No one is ever able to tell me what is wrong with him. And they have this really nice ritual where she sort of like gently brushes his skin as a way of like calming him down. And that's really nice and stuff. So I thought that was a really good aspect of it. But as you say, that kind of comes in the first half. I was not remotely expecting the twist, though. I will say that for the film. If anything, I was expecting a like, you know, they run off together in a Carol kind of esque way.
Yeah. I mean, I was expecting the twist to be that this woman wasn't really the night nurse, because there are some clues that are dropped that that she didn't ever actually follow up on getting the contact details for the night nurse, and yet the night nurse has appeared. So I thought the twist was going to be like, oh, this Mary Poppins-esque figure actually just came of her own accord and you didn't ask for her, she just arrived.
Yes. You know, that I did think of that actually, because there's a few Agatha Christie stories that pivot on that, where like for the whole way through you're assuming that someone is the detective, and actually at the end they're like, no, I never said I was the detective, you just assumed I was.
Yeah,
I wondered if it was going to be that.
But no, and I think I just struggled with how literal it took the idea that, you know, you might as a mother wish to have some of that younger energy back. I found it it really hit you over the head with the metaphor in such a way that I was like, okay, what's left after we take that metaphor out of the equation? What else is the film actually giving us? And I think the answer is quite a nice, complex portrait of motherhood at the beginning. And then in the second half, we didn't actually gain much more that wasn't kind of effectively told in the beginning. And so for me, I'm like, I wonder what the point was of that twist, other than to kind of like shock you in the watching of it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I also think that it's a little whilst, yeah, there were some good aspects of this film and you can dissect it in the way we just have, I think it's a little bit sad that you have to latch on to a film as flawed as this as like, wow, portrayals of motherhood are really improving, yeah, you know, just totally. Because it does show you, like, I think at the beginning, some good stuff about the realities of like trying to dispose of nappies and like being awake in the middle of the night totally. And not being able to get your baby to like shut up when you're trying to drive and all this kind of stuff, which I'm sure lots and lots of people really identified with that on screen. And in the same way that Juno showed you lots of things about like being a teenager and being in love and dealing with difficult decisions without having to introduce any kind of supernatural element or anything like that, I sort of wish that you could make a film about motherhood like that.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah, go and see The Escape with Dominic Cooper and Gemma Arterton, because that's kind of what that is. But yeah, not the best movie of all time.
No.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So the next thing we're going to talk about is Dude, which is a Netflix original film written and directed by Olivia Milch. It stars Lucy Hale from Pretty Little Liars as Lily. She's a high school student dealing with the death of her best friend's brother and the changes coming in her friendship group as the four girls finish school and move on with their lives. Now, for me, movies about young women coming to terms with their own mortality and the fleetingness of the kind of impossible joy of their late teenage years, sign me up, got my name written all over it. Absolutely will devour a film like that. Having said that, I think this is the worst film of all time. Thoughts?
Yeah. And it has been like widely criticized as such. There's a very funny BuzzFeed piece that I will link to in the show notes that kind of goes through it frame by frame and is like, and here's another way in which this film is the worst of all time.
The thing that I immediately found bizarre about this film going through is that there is no narrative structure.
No, there isn't.
There's just no momentum. There's no forward movement. So in the first few minutes, it's like, oh, we're all at we're all at prom, but we've still got a year left. So we're with like the older kids at their prom. And Lily is with this like super handsome boy who's her boyfriend. They're in love. And it's also the brother of her best friend. His name's Thomas. And then he's like, God, I love you two girls, to his girlfriend and his sister. And then it like slowly fades to black and we hear what I suppose is meant to be the sound of a car crash, though they never go into any detail about whether. And then he's like dead and they're at the funeral and it's super, super weepy and it's super sentimental from the off. We never ever learn. Thomas's death is like the big thing that overshadows the whole movie. We never learn how he died, which I think is a bit weird.
It's a bit weird, yeah.
And then also you assume that he died, I think, because of some clues in the narrative, because this is a big kind of like female stoner movie. That he died driving under the influence. That's what I assume.
Yeah.
But then they all drive under the influence constantly.
All the time. It's like
unquestionably.
One of my big problems with this film is that the four main characters, the four like girls who are the core friendship group, pretty much all of them, their main personality trait is driving while smoking.
Yeah. And I'm like
that is it.
I get it. It's if boys can do it in a movie, so can girls. Great. Whatever. But like not everything is inherently feminist just because it was done by a woman. And like driving under the influence is not a good thing to do, like just fundamentally. And if their really close friend slash brother slash love of their life died under the influence, you think they would take this stuff a bit more seriously, but then we never know because we never get key details like that. So yeah, and then I think this is a film where clearly they were like, oh, we need some like young, pretty, hot girls to do like masculine things and talk about their like vaginas, and then it'll be like feminist and also titillating, and we can like put a film round that. So there's loads of scenes like that where they're kind of saying like, oh yeah, how many dicks did you have in you, slut, or something like that last night, and you're like, cool, but like none of these people have personalities or motives or characters, so what's the point?
I think it is worth noting that I found it interesting that the script for this was on the 2013 blacklist, which, if you're not familiar with the concept, is this sort of like now quite famous register of unproduced scripts that are kind of bouncing around Hollywood, and they get published on this thing called the blacklist because I've forgotten the name of the guy who curates it, but basically the guy who curates it is like, these scripts are good but they are not yet produced, I'll put them on this list to like highlight annually what talent there is in Hollywood that isn't currently getting pushed out to viewers. And so this was on the 2013 blacklist, and I think this was written in the like, wow, Broad City,
totally,
like girls doing weed,
female stoner comedies can be a thing.
Yeah, and somehow from there it's now ended up on Netflix 5 years later.
Yeah, but Broad City is obviously so good because it's about like characters that you know immediately. Like the characters in it are so much larger than life, they have a friendship that you actually buy into, and so all the silly stuff around it makes sense. And also it's like got a plot each episode, for example, which this doesn't have. One thing I found particularly frustrating about this film is how all these women who are, what age do you graduate high school in the US? 17, 18?
17, 18, I think it's the same as here, yeah.
So they're all teenagers and they all behave like tiny adults.
They all look like
tiny adults as well, yeah. And, you know, it really bores me to have like really conventionally attractive Hollywood women talking about sex as a way to be like feminist, because it's also clearly aimed at like titillating audiences, some of the stuff that's going on in this. But, you know, and there's, you could say like, oh, this is a diverse film because one of the four main women is black and one of the four main women is Asian. But it's like, that's not, it's still kind of tokenism because the two lead characters are obviously white and those are the ones that you're obviously invited to actually engage with and have characters and
they're
stuff.
The ones that have the serious emotional drama. I think literally the only time I laughed in this whole film was when the black woman and the Asian woman are like, oh, let's find Lily and Chloe, you know, our token white friends.
Right.
And I was like, that's funny because actually it's the other way around.
Yeah, it's kind of, but it's, again, it's one of those things like in Sherlock where they get a female character to be like, I'm not just a female stereotype. And you're like, you can't have it both ways. You can't have your character say that and then also them be that. Like, they have to not be that to get away with saying that. Yeah, but it really frustrated me how they're all tiny adults. There's been all of them are super, super confident, even if they have like underlying insecurity issues somewhere in their lives. They're all super confident. They all talk to adults as though they're their peers. Mm-hmm. They all have incredibly adult sexual relationships, not just in that they're having sex, but that they have like an adult understanding of what relationships and consent and all these other things are. They have incredibly adult conversations about like psychoanalyzing each other and about their emotions, and they're all like totally mature enough to talk about things that are worrying them. Like, none of them have, I mean, I'm not one to patronize teenagers, but it just doesn't tally with my own experience of what being a teenager was like in the slightest. And I never knew any teenagers like that when I was growing up. I wasn't one of them and I didn't meet them, and I have no idea who these characters are at all. It's just bizarre to me.
In that regard, it reminds me a lot of, and I don't think you ever watched it because you're younger than me, but The OC, which...
No, I did. And it is kind of like that.
it reminds me like that of that in the sense that everyone in the OC was like an adult, essentially.
But they're all already. Even quippier than that. It's like that on
yeah,
steroids.
Yeah, it's worse than that. But at least in the OC, they kind of explained away the fact that they all just used to drive themselves places all the time and drink and drive and stuff by the fact that they were really wealthy.
Mm.
And that was kind of like the get out of jail free card to explain any stuff they did.
And they have done that a bit in this. They are all pretty rich, but it's just...
It's too much, though. It doesn't explain it away.
And it's more like, you know, the way that they speak to their teachers and stuff like that is just so baffling to me. It's just...
And the completely bizarre, unacknowledged plot where one of their teachers is
it's
like...
It's in a relationship with a student and that's just fine.
And that's just fine.
That's bizarre. That's, again, the sexual politics of this film are incredibly, I think, regressive, considering this is meant to be an outspoken feminist movie about, like, girls with sex lives and sexual agency.
Mm.
One of the main key plot points in this film is that Lily is raped at a party, like, literally fully raped.
Yeah.
And it's a horrible scene, and you watch her get raped, and then afterwards, not one character... has the balls to call that scene a rape scene. Like they at
not
no
even
point,
her. She calls it goals oriented sex.
Yeah. And it's like, fine, I'm happy for a lead character in a movie to get raped and not be able to come to terms with it and not be able to speak it like that and not be able to, you know, or maybe suppress it and brush it off as just like a regular but bad sexual experience, which is what the lead character does. But none of the other characters really engage with it. It's used as a way to kind of escalate the underlying problems in the movie, i.e. the strains within the friendship. It's used as just a catalyst in which to bring out the strains within the friendships. But the film fundamentally doesn't have the courage to call its own rape scene a rape scene. And that really bothers me because, again, it's having your cake and eating it too.
Mm.
And this political stuff is kind of beside the point as to why it's such a bad film, because it's a bad film because it has no character, no plot, no momentum, no empathy. You know, it's got nothing to it. But I think if you're going to market a film essentially around its politics, which is what this film is doing, then you better have the fucking balls to also make sure that it stands up to what it's selling itself as, which this film doesn't at all. It's so embarrassing.
No. That said, I think I can think of one specific way in which you might want to watch it, which is if you're in that state of hungover.
Yeah, you'd have to be so hungover.
You literally can't get out of bed. I can imagine watching this and quite enjoying it.
Yeah.
Like that.
But it's meritless.
But it's meritless. And if your brain is like functioning on more than 20% capacity, it will make you so angry you'll want to stop watching.
Yeah. So last week, Caroline recommended that I listen to The Bright Sessions, which is a podcast, a fiction podcast that, as its premise, takes the idea of people having these therapy sessions, which are, quote, for the strange and unusual.
Mm.
And I listened to the first two episodes of The Bright Sessions, series one. It's now, I believe, on series four. So I imagine it evolves into something quite different to what I've been listening to.
Yes, it does. It moves out of the confines of the therapy room.
Yeah, I'm kind of envisaging a storyline where all the patients that you get to know through these one-on-one sessions begin to know each other.
Yes, that's sort of what happens. They've just done their 50th episode, and I think they're actually quite near the end. I don't think they're going to be producing any more of it. But yeah, the 50th episode was, in best Buffy the Vampire Slayer tradition, a musical episode.
Funny, brilliant. Oh, I would love to hear that. So yeah, it's interesting because with it, by the end of the first episode, you realise that the patients are basically patients with superpowers.
Uh-huh.
They've got weird things going on. So the first patient that we hear is a woman who time travels involuntarily. So sometimes, I think maybe when she's stressed, it seems to imply, but might not be the case, she just kind of goes pale, fades away and disappears, and you can't see her anymore. And then for her, she's like ended up with the ancient Greeks or in Victorian London. And the second patient we had was this guy who's basically like a hyper empath who is feeling the feelings of other people. It's an interesting format because the therapy format allows them to kind of talk about the nuances of their superpowers, but in quite a character-driven way. So it never becomes like full of exposition in an awkward way. It's more in a like, they're talking about how their powers make them feel. And so you get a really kind of like nuanced look into how their powers function. But it never feels, you know, like in most superhero movies, it's always a bit like, so wait, he swallowed the Gargantuan and now he, you know, it's always a bit exposition driven and horrible. So it's not like that, which I really enjoy. And I guess the most obvious parallel would be to Misfits, which was the Channel 4 look into these kind of young offenders who, what does lightning strike their community center or something?
Yeah.
And they all get superpowers.
And then
superpowers.
They all become supercharged, essentially, yeah.
Yeah, so they're all like normal, different backgrounds, but all kind of ended up in a position where they're kind of struggling in society enough to be doing community service. So yeah, that's what it reminded me of. And I am quite intrigued, but I can imagine that it's grown into such a different show now that I'm kind of, I'm intrigued to know what direction it's going to go in. Are they going to team up and try and solve the world's problems, or are they going to become persecuted against in society? Or I'm curious, in because there's so many directions you can take this premise into.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to tell you where it goes, but it does definitely, it moves away from the sort of one-on-one therapy format. And yeah, definitely the different people who have all consulted Dr. Bright do like meet each other and start doing stuff and that kind of thing. So I think what happened was that Lauren Shippen, who writes and stars in it, she wrote the first season almost as like an experiment for herself. I interviewed her once and she said, because she's an actress and she'd kind of moved to LA and was trying to like make it in the movies, and she wasn't really getting that many auditions, and she was like, well, in the meantime, I'll just write something that me and my friends can be in. And that'll be fun, and we'll do it as a podcast because you don't have to get loads of equipment and all that kind of thing. And then as it sort of took off and she got more ambitious with it, I think she moved away from the format that was sort of somewhat restricting it to just being like patient doctor stuff.
Yeah, okay, well that's interesting. I look forward to seeing where it moves on to. But for next week,
we are going to take a listener recommendation. And this comes from Alana, who wrote in to seriouslypod@gmail.com to say, as you are both good old-fashioned Harry Potter fans, you should be aware of, if you aren't already, the new app Harry Potter Hogwarts Mystery. It's just been released and I've yet to play it myself, but in the tech world, it's been hyped aggressively for weeks now prior to the launch. Would love to hear what you think.
Yeah, so this is a kind of like choose your own mystery style adventure. Sorry, choose your own adventure style mystery where you pick up, you become a person, you become a student of Hogwarts. You get to kind of like design your character, you get sorted into a house, you get, you know, you choose a wand, etc. And then you turn up at Hogwarts and your brother went missing in mysterious circumstances years before. And so you're kind of, in a Harry Potter way, whispered about in the corridors. And,
right, I see. So you've started it but haven't got very far, and I haven't tried it at all yet.
Yes, yeah. So I'm really in the beginning stages, and I've just turned up at school and I've done a couple of lessons. But you can, it's very choose your own adventure style, in that it will, you'll talk to, say, Professor Flitwick, and then, you know, Professor Flitwick says, you don't seem like one for the rules, do you, Anna? And then you can be like, reply, no, I'm not. Or, yeah, actually, I try really hard to follow the rules. Or, I'm more interested in finding my missing brother. So you can, and then it, every answer you give changes. Okay. You know, you've got like percentage determinism, percentage sympathy, percentage, so your character changes according on the answers you give, and that dictates how your story goes, essentially.
Well, that sounds interesting. Sadly, it isn't exactly what I hoped, which is what I've long wanted, is Harry Potter Sims. When will they make Harry Potter Sims?
It's definitely closer to that than any other thing they've done,
where I can build like my own house in Godric's Hollow. And
I think you might just
stuff.
Need an arts and crafts set for that.
Yeah, well,
just get you some bog rolls, some toilet roll tubes, and some paint.
I wouldn't be averse to that. That sounds fun.
Hold up.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including on Apple Podcasts, where you could leave us a rating and a review if you fancy. It makes us happy and it also helps other people find the show.
If you'd like to come and see us in person, check out the events page of our website, seriouslypod.com/events. Details of our next pop culture quiz and anything else we're doing will appear there.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook and Tumblr. We're Seriously Pod on all of them. Follow us to keep up with what we're up to or to chat to other listeners about things you've enjoyed on the show.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show or hearing your thoughts on what we've already discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us on seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.